in God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Good morning, Mark Latham. How are you?
Thanks, Frank. Another huge week in politics.
Yes, it was a big week in politics, wasn't it? And I suppose it culminated with the debate on Friday. No doubt you watched it. And I was surprised. I was surprised at the reaction, the size of the reaction, and the speed of the reaction against Biden. Were you surprised or were you expecting it?
Well, I suppose Biden's detractors have known for a couple of years that he's not up to the job. You and I have spoken about it. I've said several times it's amazing that none of the senior people in the Democrat Party had tapped him on the shoulder to say, Joe, clearly you've become frail, a bit confused about your role in politics. It's ridiculous to have you running for another 4 years as the President of the United States. But they never stepped up to do that, and the reaction straight after the debate, when the obvious was crystal clear, Biden had a senior's moment, he lost the thread, but it wasn't so much what he was saying, it was more the fact how he said it, because he just looked frail and weak. Someone who physically just couldn't handle the nature of the debate with any energy and determination. So those things have been obvious to us for quite some while. But I think, you know, I watched the CNN pundits who are, you know, very much anti-Trump. And I think their reaction was, well, we've got to get rid of Biden because he can't beat Trump. You know, that performance just showed that he's so frail and weak that Trump will most clearly win this election against Biden. So they were sort of in a state of panic. How do we beat Trump was their main priority, and Biden for them was dispensable. I'll get rid of him. Who can we find that can beat the orange man? That was their reaction. But then, in the 24 hours after it, senior figures, elders in their party, Barack Obama and the Clintons, have come out and continue to back Biden. So the Democrats have got a huge problem. Biden won all the primary votes because he was uncontested, unopposed. They've got their convention in August where technically they can roll him, but they've got senior people, Obama and the Clintons, saying to keep him. So it's a huge mess, and for Donald Trump, I suppose it's a gift from heaven.
If big word, or little word, big meaning, I think is the saying, if Biden was to stand down, who would replace him? I see you've got the Vice President, Kamala Harris. Now, she is theoretically next in line, but her approval rating is lower than Biden's. What about the top contender would be the California governor, would it not, Gavin Newsom?
Yeah, and there's also Pete Buttigieg, who's sort of like a minister in the Biden administration. So, and he ran for the primaries 4 years ago and was doing quite well, a front runner, until they all collapsed and gave it to Biden. So it'd be Newsom versus Buttigieg, I think. Kamala Harris is not seen as viable because of unpopularity, and her performance hasn't been very good either. She says some stuff that you can only describe as weird. So you've got those other two, and for Trump that would be a big challenge, because Trump's whole approach in the debate and elsewhere has been to say Biden's the worst president ever, everything's going backwards. But it's a lot harder for him to do that against the fresh face who hasn't been in the White House. So it would be a big challenge for Donald Trump. You know, Trump's like sort of fixed artillery. He's a gun that'll fire on you all day, but he's not necessarily all that flexible and mobile. So a new Democrat candidate could well wrong-foot him. But at the moment, they're stuck with Biden. Brent, you just have to say it's a mess, and they're stuck with Biden, and it'd be very hard to blast him out at the convention. There'd be a lot of sympathy for him. Biden is sort of their Ben Chifley for the Labor Party. He's seen as a 50-year politician, with a good heart. He's tried hard. He's sort of been everyone's friend through that period, honest and sincere. But clearly, you know, they're replaying footage of how he debated 10 years ago. Clearly, he's in physical and mental decline, and either his family or someone like Obama need to say to him, Joe, your time is finished, you've got to retire. But until they do that, they're stuck with him.
So does this mean that people like, and you mentioned the Clintons and Obama, I mean, do the Clintons and Obama not care about the future of the Democratic Party?
Well, you'd have to say that's the case. I find it weird. You know, it's not compulsory to put out a comment after the debate, and if Obama had said nothing, it would have been taken as, you know, a recognition that Biden, his time had finished. But he came out and backed him. He said, oh, you know, you can have a bad night. Obama had one against Mitt Romney. You know, you can have one off debate. But we've got to stick with Joe. Does he care about the Democratic Party? He's either ignoring the obvious and didn't see what the rest of us saw in that debate, that Biden is frail and inadequate. Or he's got some other agenda, maybe behind the scenes. They're trying to organise who the replacement should be, and they want to give them a dream run and then execute Biden in the way of politics, you know, just chop him in the space of 24 hours.
Right.
So, yeah, it's hard to know, but, you know, with my experience in politics, not in the American system, but in political parties, these things behind the scenes are a mess, and probably the big winner is the American phone company, because all the phones are running hot. Everyone's talking to everyone and really not knowing what to do.
Let's talk about Trump, though. All the talk has been focused on Biden and how badly Biden did in the debate. So it's taken some of the pressure off, you know, how Trump carried on. I mean, Trump just made some outlandish remarks, but the comment has been made by some commentators that he must be listening to his minders because of the way he behaved throughout the debate. He wasn't, you know, jumping over Joe Biden. He was, you know, standing back, letting Biden have his say, completely different to how he's behaved in previous debates. Do you think that was because of a different approach by Trump or because of the rules that were imposed on this debate?
I think it was a strategy that the Trump and his advisors would have thought, well, if I bash up the geriatric and jump all over him and interrupt and look like a bully, I'll go backwards. Why not just let Biden speak? You know, Trump's main asset was Biden speaking, wasn't it? The longer Biden spoke and the more frail he looked, then obviously Trump was winning the debate almost by default.
Mm.
Mickey Mouse could have won that debate because it was obvious that Biden just wasn't up to it. So for Trump, it was a strategy just to let Biden show everyone the condition that he's in, which is, you know, cruel, but it's not Trump's fault. So Trump did the best thing by himself, which was to show more control than we've ever seen from Donald Trump in the past.
Yeah.
And it was funny watching the debate because when Biden would say something, instinctively you'd think, oh, Trump will be right down his throat over that and interrupt, but he didn't do that. So he showed a lot more control than we've ever seen in the past.
Okay. Let's talk about the other big news story, Julian Assange. I read somewhere yesterday, Mark, this. Assange is a difficult, paranoid and polarising character. To some, he's an inspiration. A warrior for transparency and free speech who has courageously taken on global superpowers and endured deep suffering for his principles. On the other side of the coin, to others, he's prideful and self-absorbed, a man who demands truth from power, yet weaponizes information, disregards the welfare of others, yet claims victimhood and holds people to account while avoiding accountability for himself. Peter Crest, a veteran Australian reporter, said, "We're all flawed characters, and Julian is just one of those." I suppose that's looking at the coin from both sides with Julian Assange. Another comment I read early this morning in the wee small hours. We're waiting to see him turn up as a candidate for the left in Australia.
Well, I don't know if that's going to happen, although he does get a lot of support from the Greens. Probably, you know, those quotes that you had there, Brent, the truth's probably in the middle. He's certainly no saint. He was the first of the, what you call, internet journalists. WikiLeaks was there to dump loads of information on the internet, and they got a big dump from Chelsea Manning from the American military system. Manning's paid a big price for that, and of course Assange was originally incarcerated or in trouble over rape allegations in Sweden, and the Americans were after him. He spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, locked up there in a room, hiding from the world, and then 5 years in a British prison waiting for the judicial system to deal with him. So, you know, I think one view is, look, it might have been irresponsible to dump that information out there. I'm not too sure it cost lives. The Iraq war was no raging success from the view of the Western powers. He did what most journalists would do. He was given information and he published it. But he then paid a pretty significant price with 12 years of complete loss of freedom, incarceration, and as an Australian citizen in that circumstance, it was good to see Albanese, and they said Kevin Rudd and Stephen Smith played a role, to try and free him, basically on the assumption or the the rule of thumb that, look, he's paid his price. You know, that was my feeling about him. I'm sure I wouldn't share much political commonality with Julian Assange, and, you know, maybe at a personal level he's a bit of an oddball, I don't know. But he was a whistleblower, he did what journalists normally do, and, okay, it was against the law, but he'd paid his price with the 12 years of incarceration, so it was time to free this Australian citizen. So from my point of view, it was a just outcome, and, you know, congratulations to Albanese. Albanese's been absolutely dreadful on the domestic front, but you'd have to say on foreign policy he's been surprisingly good. So this was one feather in his cap.
Let's talk inflation. Australia's monthly inflation rate increased to its highest level in 2024. The latest indication that in August the Reserve Bank may raise interest rates. Consumer prices rose 4% last month from a year earlier. The ABS said on Wednesday this week that was the case, compared with 3.6%, I think it was, for April, and 3.8% expected for May by economists. So, all in all, we were talking about this briefly this morning. I know politicians don't like talking about the R word, but are we looking? Do you think we're looking down the track, possibly at recession here? Because the politicians are like, for example, Jim Chalmers has come out today and says the government's doing everything to fight inflation, everything to fight inflation. Gee, go and talk to some small business people. I mean, things are tough in the world of small business, Mark, at the moment.
Well, what are they doing to fight inflation? I find that Chalmers comment to be delusional. All up, federal and state, Brent, with deficit budgeting, there's a $60 billion injection of public money into the economy coming on Monday. It begins on Monday with the new financial year, the 1st of July. $60 billion of deficit and debt to try and stimulate the economy. Now, that, of course, adds to inflation. You want to spend big and have big deficits, it adds to inflation. So Jim Chalmers is basically lying to the Australian people when he says that. He had the opportunity to keep the budget in surplus, as the state treasurers have, and they've blown it. So it's a huge amount of money that's stimulating the economy, and that adds to inflation. Now, I heard your conversation earlier on, are we in recession? Well, 4% inflation is certainly not an indicator of recession. The economy's not in great shape. There's still a wretched hangover from the COVID period with supply chain blockages and labour shortages. The government hasn't been dealing with that. But and the economy is quite flat, but I don't think we're heading to two negative quarters of economic growth or decline. So I don't think we're in recession, but the economy's flat and inflation is too high. So the economic situation under the management of Jim Chalmers and Albanese is terrible, quite frankly. And the cost of living crisis continues apace, and inflation obviously makes it even worse.
Now, let's talk about nuclear energy. The United Arab Emirates has embarked upon a nuclear program, a power program, in consultation with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tell me more about this, Mark.
Well, I think it's important in the debate about Peter Dutton's plan with these seven nuclear reactors that he wants to build to cut through, not by listening to propaganda and scare tactics in the Australian context, but look overseas. Is it feasible to do what Dutton says by overseas experience? Is there a country which has done something similar and it's actually worked? Well, the United Arab Emirates, so it's basically Dubai and Abu Dhabi, built five nuclear reactors within 6 years, and it was another 3 years they were operational. It cost less than $40 billion. It's been safe and effective so far, and it supplies an electricity amount generation about the equivalent of a third of what you get in New South Wales on a winter's day. So, you know, it's baseload power, it's carbon emission free, and it keeps the lights on in Dubai, where at the moment the temperature's 45 to 50 degrees and every single place has got an air conditioning running 24/7. So, you know, they've done it, and I think that example in practice shows that the Dutton plan is feasible, and a lot of the speculation about it is just complete left-wing propaganda. But, you know, the renewable rent seekers don't want competition against their renewable empire, which is massively government subsidised. They say it would cost $600 billion, the Dutton plan. Well, that's just not right, because the UAE did this on contract to a South Korean consortium. So you look at the UAE and you think, well, the Dutton plan is feasible. And I think that's a good way of judging this debate, rather than listening to propaganda from interest groups.
True. Yeah, I was reading an article when you sent through the information. I was reading an article that I Googled on it, and it's a good example, isn't it? And this is the sort of information that, I don't know, someone like a Dutton needs to get out there into the public space.
Absolutely, yeah. I think Peter Dutton would be well advised to look to practical examples overseas. A lot of countries overseas, of course, have nuclear power. It cuts through the climate change debate. It's baseload power. It keeps the lights on, keeps everyone going in their household, in their business, but it's also carbon-free. Every advanced economy is doing it except us. So Dutton needs to point to these examples. And the UAE did this, started up about 15 years ago, so it's a recent example. I put all this information on Twitter. And one wag responded, what would the renewable people say, that the UAE hasn't got Australia's advantages in sunlight? Well, they've got more sunlight than they know what to do with that.
They're
kind of similar. You know, people here say, oh, we've got so much sunshine in Australia and wind. Well, we're in a wind drought at the moment, but we do have sunshine, that's true. Well, so does the UAE. But they made a very sensible judgment that obviously when the sun's not shining, you need some form of power to keep your air conditioning running. And nuclear for them, with this South Korean venture, has worked a treat. You know, it's the perfect solution, and, you know, Australia should have done this 15 years ago when they did.
The coalition's nuclear plan, though, Mark, when you look at surveys, it is gaining support. The last one I looked at, 6 out of 10 people that were questioned are in support of it.
Well, that's a good sign. It's a difficult thing. I remember going on a parliamentary committee in South Australia where they did an examination of the nuclear issue, and when they surveyed people, said, oh, nuclear power plants, what comes to mind? People said Chernobyl and The Simpsons. You know, the cartoon show?
Yes, yeah.
Where I think they work at a nuclear power plant. So it's difficult in any country where it's new. Obviously, you can't point to a successful nuclear reactor in Australia. We've got Lucas Heights for medical purposes, but not for electricity generation where it's actually been banned at federal and state level. So if you haven't got a practical example in your own country, it does open up a scare campaign where Labor and the Greens are trying to convince people that the nuclear power station will be down on your street corner and get their vote that way. Well, we've got to look at examples overseas, and I thought the UAE really stood out as something similar to us, a similar size of electricity generation that they have, and the cost is manageable. They got it done within a reasonable time period, and we can certainly do it here.
Tucker Carlson is a former Fox News host and, they say, an influential US conservative commentator. He's been in Australia. He called a female reporter stupid and unleashed on the ABC during a confrontation with reporters at an address he made in Canberra this week. Mark, you were actually there, were you not?
I was at his Sydney event. He spoke at the ICC there at Darling Harbour. Had 1,500 people. He spoke for, oh, it must have been a bit over an hour, I suppose. And this was the day of the evening of what had been the Trump-Biden debate earlier in the day. So he spoke a lot about that. He also made the point 5 years ago he was calling out Biden as not up to the job. So, you know, what a shock that everyone can see it now. So he was making that point, and a lot of criticism of the mainstream media, and he reflected on that exchange with the journalist. The journalist involved from AAP was basically trying to say, because Tucker Carlson has said that the American birth rate is down and they're relying more on immigration for keeping their population numbers up, that he's racist. Well, that's not, you know, racist. And she was even trying to imply this is some of his comments are responsible for mass murders in the United States. Well, you know, his response was obviously to say, well, that's just ridiculous. That's not an, you can't associate those two things, people saying something in the media and then someone else goes out and there's mass murders. And he said, those shoes you're wearing, he said to the lady journalist, those shoes you're wearing, Adolf Hitler used to wear those shoes. Do you feel like you're associating with Hitler? So, you know, it's an example of the absurd to try and point out how silly it is for these journalists attacking someone like Tucker Carlson for something where he's obviously not responsible. So, you know, he's making all those points, the importance of free speech. He's pretty excitable and funny character. He's certainly very amusing. He had some things that were a bit ridiculous. He's got a few conspiracy theories he rolled out that I didn't quite like. But he was very entertaining, and, yeah, it's always good to hear from someone overseas, one of these big names, and bring them to Australia and see them in person.
Let's talk footy before I let you go. Big surprise at the result on Wednesday night. A good surprise for New South Wales supporters, not for Queensland, but it sets up a huge, what would you call it, not a grand final, but a huge final, I suppose, does it not?
Yeah, at Lang Park in 3 weeks' time. It'll be amazing to see that. And surprising match. We've never seen anything like it. 34-0 at half time. No one predicted it, thought it was possible, and New South Wales just rolled over the top. They looked totally different teams to what we'd seen in game one when Queensland dominated. So that's the beauty of rugby league football, I suppose. If you get the possession and you've got the ability and you roll forward, you can put a lot of points on in the modern game, and New South Wales did. So it sets the series alive, which is good. I thought Queensland were going to win 3-0. But we'll all have to watch the thriller in Brisbane for the decider. So it's good for rugby league, good for New South Wales, and Brent, we might even jag a series win. Who would have thought?
Exactly. Who would have thought when we lost the first one? It's always good to catch up with you. It has been a big news week, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us, Mark. We look forward to talking to you next Sunday.
Yeah, I'll be here. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks, mate. Okay, bye-bye. That's Mark Latham.